Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:22 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is March 8th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And today, this week was momentous. The Dow Jones went to a new all-time high. And at the close in here today, the S&P 500 is 25 points away from doing something similar. And the Nasdaq, which... The Nasdaq 100 was up by about 0.4% in here today, but it's bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average in the last 2 weeks. And while the absolute value is pretty similar to where it traded at exactly this point last year, if one looks at a 5 or 6 year chart, we're presented with three rather large ranges, one above another, and these ranges have tended to go on for approximately a year. And it's a pretty consistent chart pattern, and there's a definite upward bias. So one couldn't rule out the possibility that the Nasdaq 100 is going to break out to the upside in the next few months. And that is despite the fact that Apple has been pulling back over the last 6 months. And is currently in the region of $430 and really does need to break its progression of lower rally highs to begin to suggest that demand is returning to dominance in here. In Europe, we've been talking about a corrective phase in risk assets for much of the last month, and that correction was primarily focused in Europe, but the majority of these markets have found at least short-term support. And we're seeing an additional bounce into the end of the week, and particularly in Spain, where the market was up almost 3% in here today, and Italy up 1.6%, and that's despite the fact that it had pulled back sharply and that the government bond spreads had widened out somewhat following the election result. But what we are seeing is that the ECB is willing to do whatever it takes to preserve itself, and that means supporting the currency. So the euro, having had a pretty good day yesterday, has given up the entire thing in here today, and it's back down to 130. And the Europeans definitely don't need a strong currency in here. And Europe is presented with a continuing difficult situation, because there's this mountain of debt, and the chosen route to dealing with it has been austerity, and there's absolutely no growth strategy for the currency union as a whole. And it is taking its toll on respective economies. It's going to take some time, and quite a bit of time, before we can really suggest that the European economy can be considered healthy. Now, we're probably past the nadir of what was termed a crisis, and it's no longer appropriate to call Europe a crisis-ridden area, but it does have continuing problems. And when we look back at how these types of problems have been solved in the past, then currency devaluation has been almost indisputably part of the solution. And the Germans won't stand for that, and that has put Europe into a rather difficult position. But it certainly doesn't mean that the euro has to be the strongest currency in the world, and it's not in their interests. And what we are seeing is that the ECB is standing by to make as much money as is needed available to the banking system. That's been the case for much of the last year, and it will remain the case. It's also worth pointing out that over the last 30 years, Europe has never raised interest rates ahead of the USA. And it has, on occasion, had to... I think there is one exception to that, where it raised interest rates and then quickly had to reverse, and that was in 2008. And over the last 30 years, the Fed has almost always led, and that's likely to be the case on this occasion as well. Europe is not going to come out of this crisis ahead of the USA, and not least because the banking system remains impaired. And there's still these massive loans that are going to have to be written off at some stage by various banks, and that is going to take time and it's going to take additional capital. And the need for low interest rates and additional money printing in Europe remains really very well made. And that would suggest that it is going to be the Fed that begins to unwind its quantitative easing first, not least because it was the first to go into the quantitative easing cycle in the first place. When we look at Japan, the yen deteriorated again, and here today it was weaker by an additional yen, and it's down to 96 yen to the dollar. This is a consistent advance, and the explosive rally in the dollar and deterioration in the yen has broken the more than 5-year appreciation of the currency, and it's very much in Japan's interests to have a weaker currency. And if Europe needs a weaker currency, well, Japan has made it public policy, and that means that we're going to see additional weakness. And the Japanese are going to do whatever it takes to weaken their currency. And this is something that we've been waiting for a considerable period of time, but it is now in play. And with the appointment of the new central banker in the next few weeks, that person is almost certainly going to be someone who falls into the same policy mode as the current government. And they've stated that they're going to do whatever it takes to break the cycle of deflation. And of course, the other way of saying that is that they're going to do whatever it takes to court inflation. And that means printing money. That means that because they are attempting to combat deflationary pressures, and they're attempting to stoke asset price inflation, then that has been a major tailwind for the stock market. And the Nikkei today was up by over 2.5%. And it's up 18% in local currency terms this year, but only 6% in US dollar terms. And when we look at the S&P 500, the S&P is up 8.7% in US dollar terms. So this has been a powerful rally in Japan, but mostly in nominal terms. And that does help to put in perspective just how weak the currency has become. When we look at China, they're in the middle of the final stages of the handover of power. And today their export numbers came out ahead of expectations. And I've been to China twice a year for the last 4 or 5 years, at least twice a year. And something that people have been complaining about in the factories and in the wholesale markets that we've visited has been that foreign buyers just haven't been turning up. And I remember back in October, I was sitting on a plane next to a group of people that were coming back from a trade show. Now they were flying back to Shenzhen from Shanghai. And they had been to a furniture exhibition where literally nobody had turned up. And that has been really a problem for China's markets. Not only have they had inflationary pressures and wages rising, but the market for the goods that they have relied on exporting has dried up because of the European crisis and because of lower growth in the USA. So the fact that export numbers are now starting to surprise to the upside is really very positive indeed, because it suggests that the global economy is on a sounder footing and that consumer demand might be starting to come back in, and that industrial demand is starting to come back in. And that is something that has been missing over the last number of years. We've been presented in the last 4 or 5 years with liquidity-fueled rallies, and the markets have to one extent become addicted to additional money printing. But it is worth bearing in mind why we've had such money printing. And it was to avoid what was seen as an almost certain depression. But we are now starting to see that the US in particular has returned to a growth footing. It's interesting that over the last few years, we've had just about everyone who was predicting the second shoe to fall and that the market was going to collapse come out with really very bearish reports, and yet the market has continued to go higher, and it's been fueled by liquidity. But it's also been fueled by the fact that the companies that are leading to the upside are really leveraged to global growth, and they're the types of companies that are doing phenomenally well from the rise of the global consumer. And from last summer, we saw that the industrial sector and the manufacturing sector, chemical sectors, are starting to move to positions of outperformance. Now, they are sharply different from the consumer sector because they're more exposed to perceptions of global GDP growth rather than the growth of the consumer. And the fact that they've turned to a position of outperformance and that they've held onto it, and that whereas we saw consumer shares breaking out to new all-time highs at the beginning of last year, what we've seen in the last few months is that it is industrial shares that are completing more than decade-long consolidations and breaking up to new highs. Now, in technical terms, when something has done nothing for more than a decade, we consider that a base. And when we get an emphatic breakout from a base, that's confirmation that we're in a new secular bull market. So the Dow Jones is at a new high, and the S&P hasn't done it yet. And we've been in 14 years of valuation contraction, which has been characterized by lower PEs. So even though we're seeing a number of these shares breaking up to new all-time nominal highs, they're doing so at a lower PE than where they were at their 2007-2008 peaks. And of course, earnings have improved considerably over the intervening period. It's also interesting that Bill Gross revised upwards his growth forecast for the USA to 3%. Now that is substantially above the consensus in here. And if the USA is returning to a growth footing, and that is having an effect on China's export sector, then we're not entirely reliant on the Bank of China adding additional liquidity into the market. And they're going to do whatever it takes to combat the potential for the property bubble to get out of control. But at the same time, they have massive reforms that will not cost a great deal of money, but can have a major impact on the productive capacity of the consumer. And it will be interesting to see what the new government does once it's been ensconced for a couple of weeks on the reform front. With any economy, and it is really regardless of what size that economy is, we need to see that governance is improving. And China has gone a very long way by focusing on exports and infrastructure and property development. But if it's going to go further, it needs to continue on the positive trajectory of governance improvements. And it is at an important juncture right now. Because if it gets it right, then it is going to be able to develop in the same way that Japan was able to develop from an export-oriented economy to more of a domestic consumer focus. And if it fails to do so, then it's going to be locked into a middle income trap that quite a number of countries have fallen into, not least in Latin America, over the last number of decades, I should say. When we look at what the big picture is, energy prices have been coming down, and oil is now down to $91 on WTI, and we've seen that Brent crude has pulled back by about $15 over the last few weeks. The main theme that we've had at Fuller Money over what is nearly 4 years was that shale gas was going to be a game changer for the energy industry. But of course, now we have shale oil as well. And this represents a massive new source of supply, which will inevitably expand beyond the reach of North America. So commodity bull markets generally don't end because demand suddenly evaporates, but rather that supply, that investment eventually results in new supply coming to market, and that new supply sates even the most bullish demand forecasts. And of course, higher prices create demand destruction. So we're at a point where oil prices are already high. They're high in nominal terms, they're high in real terms, and they represent a barrier to economic growth. And I was reading up on this over the last couple of weeks, but by some estimates, just on a broad economic basis, a $10 rise in the price of crude oil is 0.2% loss in GDP growth for the US economy. And oil prices have risen from approximately $10 to $20 15 years ago to $90 now. So that shaves more than 1.5% off of GDP growth forecasts. And if we see that prices start to trend lower as supply enters the market and as alternatives to consumption start to come to the market, then that removes a tax on consumption. And the vibrancy of the consumer economy in the USA has been a missing ingredient in terms of the growth of the global economy. With industrial automation and a competitive advantage in energy prices, and the fact that the consumer has retrenched and the corporate sector is as healthy as it has been, it leaves the unanswered question of what exactly is going to happen to all the debt that not just the USA, but a lot of the countries in Europe and, of course, in Japan have taken on. And as we've seen stock markets rising over the last couple of weeks, government bond prices have been pulling back, and US yields have held a progression of higher reaction lows now for the last few months, and they bounced this week from the region of 1.8%, and they're back above 2%. And as long as we see that the economic outlook is improving, then the actual need for investors to hold so many bonds is diminished. And because governments are buying them, the reason that they're buying them is because they want to keep interest rates artificially low. But the actual need for that, if the economy moves back onto a more steady growth trajectory, will be decreased, and that increases the likelihood that they will be removed. And there is also something that a subscriber pointed out in an email, I think today. I didn't quite post it because I wasn't sure of the actual figures, but the general gist of it was that on a 10-year basis, because stock markets bottomed back in 2003, that the actual annual appreciation in stock markets is quite positive. And on a rotational basis, the underperformance and the relative performance of stock markets compared to what you might get in bonds as we move forward in time is improving. And that would encourage people to start reallocating back into equities. And an index that we posted a number of weeks ago was, I think the ticker for it in the chart library is STALSTOX, STALSTOX. And it's the suggested allocation of Wall Street strategists to equities. And it bottomed back in November at about 40%. And it peaked in 2000 at 72%. And that represents a massive change of heart in terms of what you really should hold in your portfolio. But it seemed phenomenally bearish in terms of sentiment, and as a contrary indicator, phenomenally bullish. Because if we're at historic lows for the allocation to equities, they can really only go up. And that means that there is a wall of money sitting in fixed income instruments that represents a pool of liquidity from which a new bull market can occur. And that's important, because you can't have a new bull market without liquidity. And there is no shortage of liquidity in terms of the money that is in bonds that could potentially be reinvested into equities. And people are starting to ask the question, will the removal of quantitative easing be a benign factor, or will it be a disaster? And I suspect that it's going to be a bit of both, because when investors have been addicted to liquidity and free money and leverage, then the reduction of the availability of money and the increase in the cost of it will put leverage positions under pressure, and not least in the high-frequency trading environment. But on a more fundamental basis, it is healthy that government bond yields start to come back up, because it's appropriate for a growth environment, and the last thing we want is an inflationary problem. That remains the really big question, because given the fact that the Fed's balance sheet has gone from about $100 billion 10 years ago to almost $1 trillion, and actually more than that in the last decade. Actually, I think it's considerably more than that, if I'm not mistaken. How they're going to remove that is really very much an open question. And gold, which has got the longest history of a store of value, has been unloved over the last few months. And it's back at $1,578, and it's been here now for 2 weeks. And that's the lower side of about an 18-month consolidation. And it really does need to hold here if the medium-term bullish outlook is to be maintained. One thing that is an indication of bullish interest in gold is the ETF holdings. And it represents a substantial pool of liquidity, and a pool of, or an investment that remains in gold but is decreasing. And it's back below 80 million ounces in here today, dropped below it yesterday. And if gold is going to bounce from this area, then it's going to need that investment demand to start to come back in. And without it, any bounce that we have is likely to be a dead cat bounce, because it has been investment demand that has helped to drive this bull market. Central banks were sellers, and they've become net buyers over the last few years. But they're certainly not a lead indicator. And it has been investors that have helped to drive the bull market in gold at the margins. And that needs to remain the case. And it's also an indication of just how popular gold is as an alternative investment. So the indicator of the ETF holdings, and you can find it in the chart library if you just type in holdings, is something that is really well worth watching, because it's back at the region of the MA. And if it starts to bounce from here, then gold is probably a buy. But if it continues to deteriorate, that's going to start to ask big questions about the sustainability of the bull market in gold. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening. I wish all the best to all of you.